Welcome to Headlines, the show to get with David Lichtenstein. This is Aryeh Leibowitz. I am covering for Rabbi David this week, and tonight we have a very exciting program. We're going to be discussing a couple of issues that are extremely relevant. Halacha lemaisa come up all the time. First, we're going to be speaking with Rav Daniel Wolf from Yeshivat Har Etzion, from Gush. Rav Wolf is a great world-renowned expert in Taharos and in the laws of Tumah and Tahara, very difficult and intricate sets of halacha. And we're going to be discussing some of the relevant issues related to Tumas Kohanim. We're going to emphasize a little bit the issue of Kohen flying on a plane that either goes over a cemetery or that carries a dead body, as this is extremely relevant when Kohanim want to fly from the New York area to Eretz Yisrael. They very often have bodies on the plane, and we'll discuss a number of other issues that Rav Wolf is going to enlighten us on. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Rav Wolf to the program. Thank you very much, Rav Wolf, for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here with you.
So Rav Wolf, I happen to be familiar with your exceptional svarim on Nashim and Kachim and Taharos, and they're so clearly written, and they analyze the figures in such a beautiful way in the halacha and the lamdas. But for the sake of those in our audience who maybe don't know that much about you, can you maybe share a little bit about yourself, just to give a little bit of background? I already mentioned that you teach in Gush, but maybe just a little bit more about where you come from and what your practical experience is in the area of Tumas Kohanim.
So, hi. So I was, I studied after high school in Gush as a student. I was through Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, and then afterwards I was 6 years with Rev Soloveitchik. And then afterwards, I came back here as a member of the staff in Gush in Yeshivat Har Etzion. And the last quite a few years, I've been where we have a very nice Kollel Elyon, which learns a lot of Masechtot off the beaten track. We do a lot of Kodshim and some other for advanced students that have hopefully covered the basic Masechtot. So we try and cover those also. I developed Taharot, and when I was in YU, there was an exceptional Talmid Chacham called Rabbi Chaim Ilson, and he was much older than me, and he sort of ushered me into this rich world of Taharot, and that's how I started that escapade.
Wow, and do people often reach out to you with questions related to flying on airplanes or going to hospitals and things of that nature?
Yes, I get a lot of those questions. A few years ago also, I don't know if it's very, in Israel it's very popular of people going to trips to the concentration camps and other areas in Poland, and they're sort of somewhat of lacking of literature, or what I deem, my humble opinion, good literature on the visiting all those sites. So I sort of took it on myself to try, and I really don't deal with halacha l'maaseh so much, but I sort of, there was a bit of a shortage of good material on it, so I sort of got into it that way also.
To Makom She'enish, you stepped up. So maybe we'll start with the following. I just had last week someone who runs a program, a learning program in Israel over the summer. Every year they take a flight out of JFK, an El Al flight out of JFK, and they've been doing this for years. And for the first time, one of the mothers of one of the young men called up and said, "My son can't go on an El Al flight out of JFK. There are dead bodies on the plane all the time when they fly out of JFK." So the person who runs the program reached out to me and said, "Do you know anything about this? Is this something that Kohanim have to be careful about?" So maybe you can, as I immediately asked first about the Metzius. I reached out to Rabbi Zon, who's the head of the National Association of Chevra Kadisha and the Queen's Chevra Kadisha, and I asked him, is it true that the majority of the El Al flights from JFK carry bodies to Israel? And he said, absolutely, the majority of the flights. He said, it's not Someone told me maybe only after Yantif or after Shabbos, where it's been a few days, but he said, no, absolutely, the majority of the flights carry bodies. So maybe you could just enlighten us on what are some of the issues, some of the tzaddim to say that maybe we can be lenient, some of the reasons to be strict about this. Give us a little bit of background on that kind of question.
There's one issue that sort of flummoxed me always, which was it would seem to be a reciprocal question, in that if it's also for Kohanim to fly in the plane, it would seem to be equally also for someone to put the bodies on the plane, because we Rambam says, and obviously based on prior sources, that nitame et hakatan, that not only is it us for the Kohen to be nitma, but we can't also defile the Kohen. So if someone, I don't really understand, and I know there are very many Gdolim who were ordained to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, I really don't understand the split. If you prohibit a Kohen to go on the plane, if flight from New York to Israel out of several hundred passengers is going to be one Kohen, I don't quite understand how you can allow interment in Israel.
Is that an Israel of Lifnei Iver, or it's a separate Israel of being Metamei Kohen?
Well, there's actually different opinions in the Achronim, but Metamei Tekatan is Lokeh, and also if you're Metamei someone who's Bishogeg, you're also Lokeh. There's different opinions in the size of the Rambam, whether that's because of Lifnei Iver or whether it's independent of Yisur of Vefilal Tam, to be in the time of the Kohen. It's sort of up in the air. It's a very good question. It's not quite clear. What is clear that it is equally Asur, and there is Malkot in certain cases. So it's not any more lenient than a Kohen being in the time of the Tamei.
Wow, so you've really amplified the question, because now it's not just a question for Kohan, and it's a question for all of us.
There's two possible ways to have a chatzitza, at least in the cases that we're talking about. We, in general, although there's certain conflicting sugyot, we seem to decide Ohel Zaruk, Lav Shmei Ohel. So as long as it's moving, there is no ahila. The plane is not considered an ohel, but the plane does come at rest. So the question then is, can the floor of the plane, assuming that people are not flying the same compartment as the mate, can the floor of the plane be a chatzitza? And we have a second rule is that kol davar tamei eno chotzeit b'fnei tuma, anything that's susceptible to becoming tamei is a plane, a kli that is mekabel tumah, will a kli be tameh or not? So here actually we have a very interesting thing. In the Torah, it really doesn't mention kli matachot, metal, per se. It mentions the six metals that were known in antiquity. The question is this some kind of a general rule for all metals? And I checked out with various metallurgists, and apparently most of the weight of the plane is made of aluminum. Up to 60% of the volume or weight of the plane is made of aluminum, which,
just to be clear, is not one of the six metals that are...
It's not one of the six metals, correct. So Rav Moshe Feinstein actually throws this out as a possibility in two independent shivot, that perhaps aluminum utensils are not susceptible to ritual defilement, to tumah. I found there seems to be a rash in Rosh Hashanah Yotet Amidbet, which seems to hold exactly that only those six metals are stated or tameh. The Rambam in his introduction to Sefer Torah seems to include metal as a general rule. And so there's a dispute. The Vilna Gaon, in his introduction to Mishnayot of Kelim, he also seems to limit to the six metals known. So I think with that approach, we basically can allow the the plane to the floor, the plane not to be mekabel tumah, and therefore the floor of the plane to be chatzitza. In addition, what I understand is chevrat kedishot now have put the mate in a special box, which itself is in the ohel and is not mekabel tumah, and that should solve the problem. So with those things, with those two, you know, heterim, first the floor of the plane, according to Rashi, and then the Gaon, and then Moshe Feinstein, the plane not being Kabel Tumah, that should be okay, and especially if the mate, and I understand that they've made special arrangements, if the mate is the box, which is not Kabel Tumah, and that would be an additional room for Kula.
If I could just follow up with one question about what you just mentioned. So just to be make sure that I'm clear on this, as far as the issue is concerned of whether the plane itself can be an ohel, so you mentioned that there are two issues. There's the issue of the movement of the plane, and then there's the issue of the material that the plane is made out of, and only something that's not mekabel tumah can itself form an ohel, and that certainly would be relevant regardless of the movement issue when the plane is on the ground and nothing is moving yet. You pointed out this machlokas, whether aluminum is one of the metals that's automatically mekabel tumah and therefore cannot be an ohel, or do you say that aluminum is just like wood or plastic or anything else that would not be mekabel tumah and can be an ohel? I'm clear about that.
Just a little correction. If there are things that are an ohel, there's three kinds of ohelot, ohelim. But when you say something's tamei can't be an ohel, it can be. There's different ways to get tumat made. One is tumat, what's called an ohel hamshacha, which is within the same room, literally a tent, but any room will do, as the mate. Because another thing is being directly above the mate. But that being said, davar tameh can be an ohel lahavituma. In other words, it is not an ohel lachtzot. A good ohel, a total ohel, has two effects to it. It can be, first of all, it can bring tuma to something lying next to it, and it can also chotzeit. In other words, if I'm on the second floor of a house, even if I'm directly above that mate, that ohel would be chotzeit. So something that's tameh or mekabel tuma is mevi tuma, will extend the tuma, but it will not be chotzeit. So it'll be stringent, an ohel lechumra, but not lechumra.
So even if the plane is considered to be made out of one of the metals that, generally speaking, is mekabel tuma, it would still be able to form the ohel that would be mevi tuma to a person in the plane if there's a dead body, let's say, sitting next to him or a few seats over from him. Okay, now just to clarify the point about aluminum, so you had mentioned that Rav Moshe and really Rashi says it, and I always wondered, I remember learning with my Chavrusa, coming across that Rashi, thinking, why is Rav Moshe such a big Chiddush? It says it in Rishonim already, but that it's the din of metal is limited to the six metals that are mentioned in the Torah. But isn't it true that planes are not purely aluminum, and they're held together very often by screws that are maybe made out of iron or some other metal, and would the laws of a maimid, of something that holds together a kli, have any effect on the tumas of a largely aluminum plane?
Well, the frames of maimid, which is literally called something that makes something else stand up, is actually used in two different ways. And here there's a little bit of confusion. There's two cases of ma'amid, but they have really different rules. One of the rules of ma'amid is when there's a glass bowl and a hole is made and it was dripped a little bit of lead to plug up the hole. That's the Gemara that also calls a ma'amid. There's another case of ma'amid, which is a case of a ladder where the side beams are called the ma'amid, and the rungs are called, or the or the Kli itself. And those are really two really different cases. And in fact, there are two different halachot. In the first case, Rabbi Meir says we go after the mamid. In other words, a glass bowl with a small plug of metal will be called metal. But there, the majority opinion, Chachamim, is that it's tahor. So the rule that we do go after mamid, halacha lema'aseh, is a case where the basic form of the kli is given. In other words, the word mamid is really used in two different sentences. Tosis there in Shabbat and Tadzayin already makes the note, but I think it's pretty obvious. I don't think it's disputed that there's one case of mamid where it's a small piece of the puzzle, but crucial or critical to the function of the kli. In that case, we say we do not go after mamid. Rabbi Meir says we do, but we decide against him. In the other case, where mamid means that the basic form is given by one object, there we say, and there the Chachamim say, we go after mamid and review this as we don't. So in the case where it's the overwhelming majority and the crucial function is done by aluminum, even though according to Rabbi Meir it would be tameh, but we decide against Rabbi Meir, it's a minority opinion, and therefore we would only go after mamid when it makes up the basic structure of the kli, and that really doesn't exist. Just for someone that's really interested in learning Kalim, the truth is that even that, there's actually some contradictory Mishnayot about axes, and there we go after the functional part. So it's even that is somewhat debatable. There's just something that's really, really interesting that happened. The newest generation of planes, both Boeing and Airbus, are making planes that aren't metallic at all. And really? They're made out of carbon fiber. Carbon fiber composite. And that probably should be tahar for everyone. So there were some issues raised about flying in certain periods and certain rural runways in Israel about flying over the cemetery in Holon. And the newest planes, it'll take a little bit of time for I think I bought a few, but it'll might take a little time for them to get to take over. But apparently, much more energy efficient. But halachically, they also have an advantage.
Wow! So just leaving out till we get to the issue of Ohel Zaruk and the fact that the planes are moving, to review where we are in the conversation at this point. So what you're suggesting is that if you're in a plane that's certainly carbon fiber, but even if it's aluminum, so it's not one of the metals, while being under the same roof as a dead body, even if that roof is made out of the metal, but certainly if it's not made out of the metals, would be a problem. In a plane, it's the body's in the cargo area, and the roof, so to speak, or the floor of the passenger section, the roof of the cargo area, will form an ohel, and that would prevent the tumma from affecting the kohanim that are in the passenger section. Is that correct to this point? And just one follow-up question. If I'm not mistaken, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I am, Rav Moshe in a tshuva, it's a brief tshuva if I recall, says something to the effect that the entire plane is a single kli. You can't compartmentalize it. Is there some idea like that you can't have this ohel within one big kli?
If the kli itself would be tameh, that would be. If the kli would be tameh, that is true that the plane should be considered one kli, and if the kli were tameh, it would be tameh as a total unit. But if it's tahar, then we can divide the. Divide the ahila into different parts.
And would you be comfortable paskening halacha lemaisa for a person flying, let's say, El Al out of JFK, where they do have a plastic ohel of sorts that they, and you certainly have a tefach in between the body and the top of the cargo area that a kohen can take those flights?
Yes. So I think the arrangement that the Chevra Kadisha has, where the body is in a separate box, what would be sufficient for that, excepting if you're, sitting directly above the mate, but I really don't think you have to be chashish for that. That seems a fairly unlikely occurrence.
Right. Is it a worthy thing to try to be machmir? I'm told there's one flight out of Newark each day where they guarantee that there's no mace. Is that a worthwhile chumrah, or is that just silly?
It seems a little bit of a stretch, but I can't make a decision for other people. It's not an impossible position that it's also, but it seems. I think the kula is well based and good. For someone that's a bal nefesh, I can't say that there's no logical possibility that it would be prohibited. That I cannot say. I can say it's a good based tether. I think it's a good kula. I think it's probably the correct psak to say that there's no opinion or that it's preposterous to think otherwise. That I can't say.
Right. Okay, well, just to touch on a couple of other issues, aside from airplanes, in New York, they opened a few years ago a 9/11 memorial where, I don't know the details, you probably do, there are some body parts and some concerns of Tumah. In addition, there seems to be a traveling exhibit of human remains called the Bodies Exhibit, where you just walk around and see bodies in different states of different poses, I guess. Can you comment on the permissibility of a Kohen to visit either of those things?
There's a dispute about a Meit Nachri, and it's a dispute in Tanaim, and it's a dispute even in the final Psak, where the Bali Tosaf, where the Rambam says, non-Jewish body is not metame ba'ohel, and Tosfot seems to be more allowing of opinion that it is metame ba'ohel. In Shulchan Aruch, also there's a split. The Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber Yosef Karo, that Mikar Hadin, a god is not metame ba'ohel, but one should be machmir. So in those cases where there's additional reason to be mako, where there's some great need, so people are mako to be in the ohel amek. I don't think in the body exhibit, I don't think that quite makes the cut. So for people that are possibly drama, I think that should be avoided. In terms of the 9/11, and this is a problem I had, I assume the only thing that's left over are little splinters of bone. And there we have that even in the Jewish bone, there's a certain limit to the amount of bones. It's actually an extremely complicated issue. Is around six different opinions in Yishonim, and they're very, very unclear what they are, about what set of bones in the time of the OL, but it has to be a significant amount. It has to be probably Rov Minyan Ubinyan, the most bones that constitute either a majority of the bones, which means 120 odd bones.
And it has also from a single body?
Oh, yeah, so that is actually a dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Chachamim, but we say it has to be from a single mate, that from different bodies they do not add up. So we need a Rov Minyan Binyan from one body. It seems to be quite unlikely, and that was the problem, not the problem, but that was the basis of the leniency for the concentration camps, that the bones were in the state which were decaying. But certainly the 9/11, I understand, is just like bone fragments here and there, nothing close to Rov Minyan Binyan, and nothing close to being the flesh of the corpse of Basar, which would be a Kizayit. And as you aptly noted, we do not add up the bones from different people. So case of the bodies, I understand that there's really human flesh and whole skeletons that are under a roof, so that's a clear case, which seemed to be a clear case of a Meit Nachri, that we are machmir, that there should be in time of ba'ohel. The case of the 9/11, that there we're talking about small pieces of bone fragments, nowhere close to Rov Minyan Binyan, certainly not of one mate, and we don't add up, so that would seem to be totally allowed. As long, by the way, as long as one doesn't, I assume we're not talking about touching the bone fragments, removing them.
Mm-hmm. As far as visiting the concentration camps and the Holocaust trips to Poland and the like?
So there too, there's actually this other really interesting issue, which is, do you believe that there's this general rule, safek tumah b'shita rabim tahor, any doubt of tumah in the public area is tahor. What's interesting is that the Gemara never mentions what is the rule by Kohanim. Tzimtzit Chinuch actually raises this as a question. What is there a rule safek tumah b'shita rabim for? Correct. So I actually had a long discussion with my Rebbe Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal, and I asked about the quandary, and I said I sort of felt bad of sort of taking this liberties and sort of decisions on myself in this area, but it just seemed to be impossible to sort of write a cogent tshuva, and there's really a sort of a lack of halach matil. And Hilchot Shabbat, we never are called on to really decide between different Rishonim. You know, it's all been decided before in the Shulchan Aruch, or for the most part. And here I just felt like you just have to decide. So he sort of told me that he thinks, you know, you have to, like, allow people to have a little bit more, you know, courage than one might have in other areas. So here also, I laid out an argument which I think is persuasive of why you should allow for safek tumah b'shita rabim. The other questions are also, as I mentioned before, these are bodies and these are Jewish remains, but you need a whole skeleton. Basically, there is no human flesh left over. You need a whole skeleton in relatively pristine condition, which I understand does not exist in the village. In Israel, you actually can find whole bones that are totally dry, but in the wet areas of Poland, they're all broken. And I talked to several people at the digs in the Eastern Europe, and the bones are never whole. And in addition to this other halacha that you can't add up from different meitim, I thought. I had certain strictures, but basically I tried to allow for visits in most of the camps. My general rule was that in cases where there's no reason to believe there's meitim, there's only safek meitim, that would be allowed with a safek ohel. And the cases where there's a vadai meitim and a vadai ohel, that should be refrained from. There's also trees are an incredibly complex issue, and there's three different disputes of Rishonim that are very hard to decide, and every tree is really different. So on the whole, there were different areas, but basically in the camps, there might be meitim outside the bunks, like say in Auschwitz, but there's no reason to believe so, and that's under the air. In the bunks, you know, it's possible there's some meitim underneath the bunks, but that I found, I thought was fairly unlikely. And there's also additional reasons to believe that an ohel above ground would not add up the atzamot below ground. So I there were some areas that weren't barred, but on the whole, I think Kohanim can go on these trips. The Batek Farot were possible in Warsaw and in Lodz. Those are, you know, popular Batek Farot. Those are impossible. I found those impossible to visit. But besides that, most of the camps, most of the areas were okay, as well as the places of the Einsatzgruppen and killed Jews in the forest. I thought that if you would just stand a few rows away from the pit, a few trees, row of trees away from the pit of killing, that would be allowed also. But directly on top of the pit, I thought that was that would be a sur, and also to take two rows of trees, safety precaution.
Okay, Rabbi Wolf, I could think of dozens of more questions I would want to ask you. Unfortunately, we have limited airtime, but I thank you so much for sharing your expertise, your knowledge. It's such a difficult thing to find people who are well-versed in this area of halacha. And thank you for your guidance. And I'm sure the audience thanks you for your guidance and for your knowledge and for sharing. And thank you very much for agreeing to come on the air with us. Welcome to Headlines, and thank you for joining us. This week we are covering a couple of topics that are very relevant, halacha l'maisa, and I can tell you as a shul rabbi, this is again Aryeh Leibowitz filling in for Rav David Lichtenstein this week, and I happen to be a rabbi of a shul in North Woodmere on Long Island, and I can tell you that the questions that we get sometimes are very challenging. And one of the more challenging and unfortunately common issues that comes up are people discovering major problems with Sifrei Torah, tefillin, mezuzahs, having a 35, 40-year-old guy discover that his tefillin were never kosher, even though he had them checked every few years, and things of that nature. So we have with us tonight Rav Reuven Mendelowitz, who is a sofer and an author of really just an outstanding book, an outstanding sefer on issues relating to Safras. It's called Inside Stam. I bought the book and read it before I ever met Rabbi Mendelowitz, before I ever even interacted with him, and I was blown away, because in a matter of a couple of days, you can go from knowing absolutely nothing about these issues, which I think is what most of us know about these issues, to having a working knowledge of what to be looking for, what to look out for, and to understand how one should go about buying tefillin, mezuzos, megillos, sifrei Torah. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Rabbi Reuven Mendelowitz to the program. Welcome, Rabbi Mendelowitz.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Leibowitz, for your generous introduction. Shalom Aleichem.
Aleichem Shalom. So, as I mentioned, I know you as the author of Inside Stam, as well as we correspond somewhat frequently, but to give an idea to those members of the audience who maybe don't know you as well, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, about your training in Safras, about what you do on a given day? Are you working on the writing end, the checking end, the teaching end? How exactly, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. As far as a general overview, I'm a regular guy from Flatbush, like everybody else. And I came to Eretz Yisrael as a bacher, I guess it's about 22 years ago. And at some point, after learning in Kolo for some time, I became interested in Stam. And when I did that, so I went through the halachas a few times. And once I had a working knowledge of them, so a few people suggested that maybe I should try and turn it into something more practical. So I took some advice to try and see who would be the most worthwhile person to go to, and I found out that the person who's generally considered to be from the best teachers in the world today is a fellow in Yerushalayim by the name of Rabbi Yisrael Hyman, and I went to him and I learned how to write from him. As far as what area I specialize in, so that would be the area of Hagah. There are seferim that write the Stam, and then there are the Magiim that check the Stam. So I learned how to write, and I know how to write, but primarily I spend my time mostly in the checking end of it, which is referred to as Hagah, and I check Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzos, etc. And most of what I know and most of what I learned from my Rebbe, Rabbi Friedlander. Rabbi Mordechai Friedlander, he was the head of the Mishmeres Stam in Yerushalayim. He was the Talmud Muvik of Rabbi Yashiv. Specifically in Hilchos Stam, he spent about 25 years by his side. He asked him thousands of questions in Hilchos Stam. He was widely regarded as one of the leading experts of Stam in the world, if not the leading expert of Stam in the world. Rebbe Yashiv said about him that he was a Yachid B'dayre in Stam, and I was fortunate enough to have a very, very close relationship with him for a long time, about 12 or 13 years, and unfortunately he passed away very suddenly a couple of months ago, and it's been a tremendous shock and blow to the Stam world in general, and anything that we can try and do to make the situation of Stam better in the world would be certainly an Ilui for his neshama.
Wow. So getting right to it, I guess, when it comes to buying Stam, for most people, I know for me, and I really think for a large majority of the people, it's very similar to going to getting your car fixed if you know nothing about cars, where the auto mechanic can tell you anything, and you would just nod and say, yeah, sure, because you have no idea. So it seems that that's a problem. So how, but we all need to buy it. We all need to buy Stam. How is an average consumer supposed to know whether the person that they're going to, you know, is it the length of his beard, how nice he smiles? How do we figure out whether he's a reliable person or not?
Wow, that's a loaded question. It's definitely perhaps the most important question when purchasing Stam, since, as you say, we're basically totally reliant on the person whom we are buying from. I would say that there are a few ways that one can determine if the person that he's planning on buying from is somebody who is reliable or not. The unfortunate reality is that many of the people who are selling Stam don't know all that much about it themselves. It's interesting because it's unlike other things that a person goes to buy, like if somebody's going to buy a suit, so it's highly unlikely that the person selling him the suit doesn't really know anything about suits. And so it is with anything else that he's looking to buy. But with Stam, very often the people that are selling it, they themselves are not quite that knowledgeable in the area themselves. So I would say that there are a few things that somebody can do to acquire some knowledge and to check out whether or not the person is reliable. The first thing that he could do is to gain some knowledge about the subject. As you mentioned, there are Svarim around today that Baruch Hashem have attempted to address that need. And if somebody reads up a little bit about what it is he's buying, just like if you buy anything else, very often people will read the reviews and see what people who have purchased it in the past have said. So too, somebody nowadays, when they're purchasing Stam, there are avenues with which they can familiarize themselves with the subject. So that's the first thing that I would suggest that somebody does, is to gain a working knowledge of what it is they're going about purchasing. The second thing that I would think is definitely worthwhile is to speak to people who are knowledgeable in the subject themselves. Now, there's very often, let's say somebody decides he's going to be medactic in the mitzvah of matzah, or arba minim, or whatever mitzvah it may be. So very often there are people that are well known as mumchim in hilchas matzah or mumchim in arba minim, and people will seek those people out and try and speak to them to see what they have to say. So that would often be a good idea as well. Getting more to the practical end of it, once we're actually dealing with the seicher, the broker who's going to be selling the stam, so it's imperative to ask him whether or not the seicher who's writing the stam and the magia who's checking the stam are certified. Just like if you want to drive a car, you have to have a license. You want to work in insurance, you have to be licensed. So too in stam, there is a license. It's called a tu'uda, and it involves a written test and an oral test, and there are recognized organizations that give out these tu'udot, and it's very important, it's crucial, and imperative that one asks the seicher, the broker, if the seicher who's written the stam and the magia who's checking the stam is certified.
How many Another organizations thing, are there that certify?
The two most recognized ones amongst the Ashkenazim are the Mishmeres Stam, which is in America and in Eretz Yisrael, and the Eda Charedis, which is in Yerushalayim in Eretz Yisrael. Since I would say 95% of the Stam in the world comes from Eretz Yisrael, so you know, if a Sefer is in America, he's basically working with the Mishmeres Stam, which I'll take this opportunity to mention, is a fantastic organization, and they really took Stam from a mace mitzvah and turned it into a subject that people actually, at least the people involved in the field, have somewhere to fall back on and someone to rely on, someone who provides, an organization that provides certification and testing. and they really revolutionized the world of Stam in the last 40 years. For Sfaradim, there's an organization in Bnei Brak. It's called Yad Rafael, and they provide testing as well, although the Mishmar Stam and the Eidei Haredes also do testing for Sfaradim. So ascertaining that the Sefer and the Magia are certified, as I mentioned, is absolutely crucial. Another thing that a person can do is to ask the broker one or two halacha questions. Now, obviously, a person's not going to be able to do this if they don't do a little homework in advance, but it's worthwhile doing that homework, because very often what will happen is when somebody starts asking questions, suddenly the answers sometimes are not necessarily forthcoming. So if the cipher is well-versed in the subject, is well-versed in the subject and he has ready answers, then at least you know you're dealing with somebody who is familiar with the subject and knows a little bit about what's involved. Another thing that he can do is two more things, and this is perhaps the most important thing, is to ask the broker who he goes to with the shailas. And that's very, very important, because there's no such thing as a cipher or a magia or a broker that doesn't come into shailas. There are always, always shailas. There are hundreds of halachas involved in writing stam and checking stam, and there are shailas that come up every single day. In Yerushalayim, if you go to the Batei Hayra, where the Rabbanim sit and answer questions on stam, there's an overflow of people coming in with shailas constantly. So I would just ask the broker straight up, who do you ask your shailas to? And he should have a ready answer, because there definitely are going to be shailas. And if he doesn't have an answer to that question, I think that might be the most important issue that we're discussing. And finally, another very good idea is to ask the broker if you would be able to bring the parashiyos to your own magia. And again, a lot of these ideas are not necessarily because we're trying to bring it to our magia, that our magia will find problems that his magia didn't find, or because we're trying to ask him halachic questions and catch him, but we're just trying to see what type of person it is we're dealing with. And if he has ready answers and he says, no problem, take it to your own magia, then you see that we're dealing with a person who's an honest person, who's knowledgeable about the subject. But if he starts becoming nervous or wishy-washy, and he doesn't really want, in other words, I don't know, I haven't lived in America for a while, I'm not sure how it works in regard to Arab Aminim over there, but over here, if somebody wants to buy an Estrig, so it's perfectly acceptable and it's very common that the person will say, okay, I'm very interested in this Estrig, but I'd like to bring it to my Rav first for him to have a look at it. And that's standard practice. And there's no reason in the world why that shouldn't be the same in Stam, that a person should just be able to say, I'd like to take it to my Magia, even if you don't have a Magia. Say it anyway, just to see how the person reacts. That's, I think, a good idea also.
Just to go back on the Mishmer Stam issue, just one more question relating to Mishmer Stam, because I really don't know much about the organization, and I suspect a lot of other people don't either. I had recently, actually told you about this privately, but I had recently a situation where someone had a Sefer Torah in the family, and they knew that there might be problems with it, so they had it checked, and the sofer who checked it said it's absolutely puzzle. There's no way to make it kosher. It was what he said was a slonimer sefer Torah, which we don't have to get into the details right now. And then the person who owns the Torah, since it was a very emotional thing for her, it was her husband's Torah. Her husband had passed away, and she brought it to someone else, and someone else said, oh, no problem, $2,000, I could fix up the whole thing. Is there would Mishmer Stam adjudicate something like that? Can both sides go to some sort of recognized organization and get to the bottom of something like that?
I don't know if Mishmer Stam themselves would deal in Dinei Torah and things of that nature. They're primarily there as a source of information and to make sure that the Seferim and the Magiyim are up to par. So I'm not sure if they would officially adjudicate such a dispute, but I do know that Rabbi Friedlander, Zichrono Livracha, on many occasions that I was personally involved in, was happy to act as a mediator or some sort of arbitration between two sides that had a disagreement. And and his word at least was final. It was always accepted, and that was, but again, that wasn't, I wouldn't say that that was a official function of the Mishmeres Tam to act as a Bezdin, but the Mishmeres Tam is certainly an invaluable source of information, and they could definitely could provide either one of the sides or both of the sides with any background information that they would require for such a dispute, that's for sure.
I'll tell you, the way that often people buy stam here, and I think it's unfortunate. I know many people who buy houses for the first time because I'm privileged to be a rabbi in a growing community, and the people will tell me, they'll go into the local Sfarim store, or not even Sfarim, the local Judaica store, and they'll ask whoever's behind the counter, do you sell mezuzahs? They'll say, sure, we have three levels. We have $50 mezuzahs, $70 mezuzahs, and $100 mezuzahs. And the person will say, well, okay, so there's low level, mid level, and high level. I'm about a mid level Jew, so I'll buy, $15, $70 mezuzahs. And that's the extent of it. What kinds of problems are they opening themselves up to when that's the level of the research? Like, what could be wrong with the $70 mezuzah, let's say?
There could be dozens of things wrong. For instance, if the cipher is not knowledgeable, he may have written the mezuzah shelo kesidron. There's a halacha that the mezuzah has to be written in order, and if there's one letter that's out of order, then the whole mezuzah is pasul midaraisa. So if the cipher is not knowledgeable,
and that you wouldn't be able to tell by looking at it.
You'd never be able to know. There are many things you would never be able to know. For instance, being Mekadosh the Shemos, a cipher before he starts writing a mezuzah, he has to say L'Shem Kedushas Mezuzah. And before he writes each Shem Hashem in the mezuzah, he has to say L'Shem Kedushas Hashem. And if a cipher is not knowledgeable in the halachas, and this has happened many times that I personally am aware of, that the cipher did not know the halachas, and they wrote mezuzahs with the Shemus, without saying L'Shem Kedushas Hashem before each mezuzah, and the mezuzah may look beautiful, maybe $150 mezuzah, but if the cipher doesn't know what he's, if he doesn't know the halachas, then you could run into major problems. So when you're dealing with a situation where you have $50 mezuzah, $70 mezuzah, $100 mezuzah, etc., if you don't know the background of the people who are writing the stam and checking the stam, there could be a situation where the less expensive mezuzah is actually more mehudar, because there were no problems that were run into along the way, while the more expensive mezuzah, he may have bumped into a problem and made an erasure, which is halachically problematic. There are many halachas involved, including chaktoichas, that letters have to be formed by writing and not by erasing, and those halachas are extremely intricate and involved, and if the cipher is not a real expert in the halachas, he can easily write a mezuzah in a way that's not kosher, and nobody would ever know the difference.
When you check tefillin mezuzahs, I'm sure you often find psulim. How often? I mean, what percentage of, if you walk into a shul on a weekday morning and there are 100 men davening, what percentage of them are probably wearing pasul tefillin?
To answer that question, I would have to make a clear differentiation between different types of people. There are people, in spite of what we said a moment ago, that sometimes the less expensive mezuzah could be more mehudar than the more expensive mezuzah. I just meant that as an example of what could be. But the reality is, like anything else in life, you get what you pay for, if you're lucky. And therefore, I have found that people who are serious B'nai Torah and spend serious money on their tefillin and mezuzahs, the percentages of problematic items is much lower. Certainly there are problems even amongst that segment of society, but the percentage is significantly lower. Regarding what we'll call the hamainam of people who buy stam without doing any homework and they just buy a lower level item, the percentages, difficult to give an exact number because there are dozens of things that there's a machlokes apeiskim if it's kosher or not. For instance, if it's missing a kutza shel yud, so we paskin that that's not kosher, but there are shitas in the achrenim that are mekel. There's an issue of chetzi aish shel kesidron without getting into all the halachic details about that, that could also be a situation where something could be less than mehudar. And there are dozens of other such examples, questionable things that could be fixed according to some shitas and not be fixed according to other shitas. So it's impossible to give a hard number of what is not kosher, because many things could be considered b'di'evid according to some, pasul according to others, even l'chatchilo according to yet others. But I would definitely say that there's no question that the majority, perhaps even the vast majority of stam that is inexpensive, we'll call it, is certainly very much halachically problematic. I've heard from other magiyim, they wanted to put the number as high as 80 or 90%, and I don't know that I would disagree with that.
Wow. Is it true that, you know, I hear people often say that you don't really have to get your tefillin checked, because once they were checked once and they're closed up, they're never going to become puzzle unless you, like, go swimming in them or something. But if you treat them with basic decency and respect, nothing will happen to them. A, is that true? And B, is it therefore advisable, once you get your tefillin checked once by someone good, to not get them checked again?
It's definitely something that I've heard many times myself from many people, including Rabbanim and people even who are in the field, that they say, as you just said, that once the tefillin are closed up, there's no reason to check them again. There are even such opinions brought from what I would consider to be the G'dayli HaPeskim, stating as much. However, I'm not saying that I'm fit to argue on the G'dayli HaPeskim, but I would say that my experience has shown, at least, that it's not really the case, because granted, if a mezuzah was written without a letter missing, which would passel the mezuzah, so when you check it in 20 years from now, there's not going to all of a sudden be a letter missing. That doesn't happen. But what does happen very, very often, especially in tefillin and in mezuzahs as well, is an issue of letters fading and letters cracking. The ink that's used nowadays by 99% of the seferim is an ink that does fade. Even though the Mechaber says in Shulchan Aruch that tefillin don't have to be checked, apparently the Mechaber was working with a type of ink which is described by the Rambam that does not fade. Our ink definitely does fade. If you open up any pair of tefillin in the world that was written 100 years ago, today, 99% of the time you will find that it's faded to the point where it's no longer kosher according to the vast majority of shitas. So that means that at some point between 100 years ago and today, the tefillin became puzzle because the letters faded. So do we know if it happened 90 years ago or 80 years ago or 60 years ago or 40 years ago or yesterday? No, we don't know. But we do know that at some point it becomes not kosher. Another issue, which I mentioned before, is cracking letters. Very often when putting the tefillin shel reish into their individual compartments, the tefillin shel yad is written on one piece of cloth which goes into one compartment, and the tefillin shel reish is written on four pieces of cloth which go into four compartments. And to get those four pieces of cloth into their respective compartments, the cloth has to be folded and squeezed in. And very, very often that can cause letters to crack in the folds. So therefore, the fact of the matter is that anybody who checks tefillin and mezuzahs on a regular basis will find very often letters that over time have faded. Sometimes it'll take more time, 20, 30, 40 years. Sometimes it'll take less time. It could even happen. I checked two pairs of tefillin from Bahrain, two brothers. They were, at the time, I believe, about 19 and 20 years old, and they had purchased just their tefillin parshias for $2,000 apiece from one of the top seferim in the entire world. And I checked their tefillin, like I say, about 6 or 7 years after they purchased them, and the tefillin had already become puzzle because the letters had faded. So I would say that people definitely should check their tefillin. How often is a good question. It's a question that can't be answered with any specific number. Just by the way, parenthetically, it's not like I woke up and I'm arguing on the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch who says that tefillin don't have to be checked. There are a number of Achrayim, including the Chayyadim and the Melech HaShemayim and many others, that they already point out what I'm mentioning, and that is that nowadays, tefillin do fade and crack. So I would say to go with the Aruch HaShulchan's statement. Aruch HaShulchan says in Siman Lamed Tes, in Shulchan Aruch, that one should check their tefillin be'ezes man, which I would translate in English as meaning once in a while. So what's once in a while? I don't know. Once in 10 years, once in 12 years, something like that. And I think if a person does that, he very often will catch the problems before they reach the puzzle stage when they can still be fixed, and in that way extend the life of his tefillin and mezuzahs for a long time.
Right. Okay. Now, you mentioned that in the times of the Mechaber, they were probably using a type of ink that was stronger and wouldn't fade. Has Safras gotten weaker or stronger over time? And I've heard people say that the Chavetz Chaim could have only dreamed about having tefillin as nice as the tefillin that every bar mitzvah bachur gets today. Is that true? Or has the status of Safras gotten better, worse?
That's a statement that I've actually heard a number of times, but that doesn't mean that somebody should go and buy tefillin like the Chavetz Chaim had in 1920. If the Chavetz Chaim was alive today in 2017, he wouldn't be purchasing tefillin like he had in 1920. He'd be purchasing tefillin, mehudar tefillin, like we have today. There definitely are things that change. One thing that changed is that there definitely are more good seiferim around. Klal Yisrael used to be that there was one sefer in every town, and people would order from that sefer. Today you have, in cities like Yerushalayim and Beitar, Kiryat Sefer, Beit Shemesh, you can have thousands of seferim in each city. And obviously if you have that amount of seferim, you're going to have very many of them that are very good. So even though it's true that the number of seferim who are not very good also has multiplied, but at least the pool of seferim who are good has certainly expanded greatly. So therefore, that definitely changed, that there's much more good stam available to be purchased today. As far as the technology, it's definitely true that technology has helped a lot in terms of making batim. Reb Nisano, who passed away in, I think it was 1917 or 1918, he was the first person who ever made batim out of what's called gaseis. There's thin animals like sheep, which are called dakeis, and then there are larger animals like cows, which are called gaseis. Tefillin were always made from dakeis, thin animals, and Reb Nisano was the first one who started making tefillin from gaseis. Since Reb Nisano and Reb Nisano's tefillin were very mohudar. Both the parashiyos, I've checked some of Reb Nisano's parashiyos, and they were absolutely beautiful. But again, Reb Nisano was a chad b'deire. Today, you have hundreds, literally, of seferim who write on a level of Reb Nisano or nicer. I'm not saying that they're tzaddikim or mekubalim like he was, but at least in terms of the umnis shabai, the craft, there are many people today who have far surpassed Reb Nisano. The klap today is much better klap. The batim today is much better batim. And all these things are very much due to advances in technology. So yes, there definitely is a big difference between what's available today and what's available then.
Wow. Now, what you hear a lot now is that people get things, either they're tefillin or the Sefer Torah or mezuzahs, computer checked. Does that mean that a computer is better than man, and therefore you have no concerns? I know you discussed this in the book, but for the benefit of those who haven't read your sefer yet.
The computer definitely is better than man in one sense, and that is in terms of checking for spelling mistakes. From the first 100 Sefer Torah that were put through the computer when it was first created, I think it was in 1983, something like that, from the first 100 Sefer Torah that went through the computer, they found spelling mistakes in 83 of them. And these were Sefer Torah that obviously had been checked. So clearly the computer is a major, major upgrade in terms of checking for spelling mistakes. Now a great misunderstanding, which you alluded to, is the fact that that's really all the computer is reliable for. The computer is not reliable for anything else. For instance, if you have letters, there are many letters that have tagim, little crayons on top. If you have one tag that's detached from the letter, you're getting into a serious machlekes achreinim if the tefillin are kosher at all, if the entire Sefer Torah is kosher. So there is, as I say, it's a machlekes achreinim, but that's something that the computer would never catch, almost never. Similarly, a cracked letter. You have letters that are comprised of multiple components. And very often you'll have a letter that's detached, for instance, an aleph. It has a yud on top and a yud on bottom, a line in the middle, which is somewhat similar to a vav. So let's say, for instance, a very, very common thing that magim will find is that the top yud is detached from the letter. Why that is a technical issue, but that's the fact. You'll find that very often. Things like that the computer will almost never catch, and it's certainly not reliable at all. So stam definitely needs to be checked by people, and the computer is not a end-all and be-all. Another very important thing to point out is that in spite of the fact that the computers are extremely reliable, I would say 99.99% in terms of catching spelling mistakes, the fact of the matter is that the computer has to be manned by a living human. Computers don't work by themselves. You have to have somebody who's the technician, for lack of a better term, who's taking care of the computer checking. And the technician is a human, not a computer. And he can make mistakes. So very often you'll find Sifrei Torah that have been through a computer check, and yet they'll still find a spelling mistake. And almost always the reason is because of the human error involved. So computers, while definitely are highly recommended and should certainly be utilized and praised for everything that they have done, or at least the people that created the computer check should be praised, but it's not like the computer has solved all the world's problems.
Right. So when someone says that, oh, it's been computer checked, so I know it's fine, that's not necessarily true. It's a good step, but not necessarily true.
Yeah, it's definitely a good step, but it's definitely, it's not, no. It means, I mean, to put it in a very sharp term, it means nothing in terms of the kashrus of the Sefer Torah. Unless you know that the Sefer Torah has been checked by at least two extremely competent human magiim, the computer check really has no bearing on the kashrus of the stam item.
Okay. Now, just maybe a couple more questions, one or two more questions. We're running out of time already. But I guess, very practically speaking, I go into a store or I go to a broker and I ask all the questions that I'm supposed to ask that you referred to earlier. How much should a nice mehudar mezuzah cost? And similarly, tefillin. I want to make sure that my bar mitzvah bachur gets a lot of times people say, oh, he's 13 years old, what does he need a beautiful pair of tefillin, without realizing he's going to be wearing those tefillin when he's 30 and when he's 40 and when he's 50 also.
Right.
How much should a nice pair of tefillin cost and should a nice mezuzah cost?
Well, I can tell you the following. I was in America a couple of years ago, more than a couple. I would say it was about 6 or 7 years ago. And there was an individual who was very ill, and their family asked me to check the mezuzahs there. And I checked the mezuzahs, and they were not up to par. And so I was left with the mission of finding a at least kosher lechatchila mezuzah to replace the problematic ones with. And we're talking about the greater New York area. And I went around, I started looking for mezuzahs, and I saw mezuzahs for $30, $40, $50, $60. And the first mezuzah that I saw that I felt, and I'm not talking about kosher lemahadrin min mahadrin, I'm talking about what I would consider to be kosher lechatchila, and this is 6 or 7 years ago, the least expensive mezuzah that I found at the time was $77. And at the time, I remember I asked the broker, who's a very reputable broker, he came very highly recommended, I said, I don't understand. I said, you just showed me mezuzahs for $30, $40, $50, which are, you know, somewhere, we'll call it in the bid-the-ebid range. Why don't you just sell the $77 mezuzahs and higher? Why do you even sell the mezuzahs that are halachically problematic? And he looked at me in all earnestness, and he told me, he said, listen, he said, I'd love to only sell these mezuzahs. He said, but nobody wants to buy them. He said, you're the first person that's asked for this level of mezuzah in years. So it's not necessarily always the brokers that are the issue over here. Sometimes the general public, the power lies with the public, and if the public looks for better stam, then the public will find better stam. But in order to get better stam, one has to be prepared to pay. It's no different than a car. If you're going to pay $17,000 for a new car, you're not going to get a very good car. But if you pay a little bit more, you can get a good car. And Stam is really no different than anything else. If somebody is prepared to pay what it costs to get a good Stam item, and like I just said, a mezuzah, I can't give, you know, general rules, but I do know that over the years I have walked into various places in the greater New York area, and I've looked at mezuzahs and tefillin and so forth, and I, as I say, I could not really find kosher lechatzila mezuzahs for less than $70 or $80. As far as tefillin are concerned, again, I live in Eretz Yisrael, so it's very difficult for me to give American prices. Obviously, the market over there is very great, and I understand that, that there's nothing wrong with that. But I would estimate that it would be very, very difficult to find tefillin parshiyos that are kosher lechatchila without any shilas at all for less than $400 or $500. I don't know if that's even possible. And I would say the same thing with batim for tefillin. For less than $400 or $500, I don't really know that it's too practical to find something that could be considered kosher lechatchila without any questions.
So maybe just one final question. Are there any topics that I haven't asked you about that I should have that you think are important for people to know about?
Oh, wow. What would come to mind would be the issue of hechsherim. It's a painful topic, and it might not be so politically correct to speak about it, but I think it's important for people to understand the realities, and even if it's unpleasant, but I think it should be mentioned. There are tefillin batim. There is no hechsher at the moment on mezuzahs and on tefillin parshiyos. Doesn't exist at the moment. For whatever reason, there's no such thing as a hechsher on those items. But on ritzuos and on batim for tefillin, there are hechsherim. And somebody who's familiar with the situation will know that there are wild price differentials between various hechsherim. You can get batim with a hechsher for much less than the amount that I mentioned before, and you can get ritzuos for tefillin also with a hechsher that says on it lemahadrin v'nemahadrin for less than half the price of what other ritzuos would cost with a different hechsher. And it's not politics. It's a simple matter of the issue is that the more expensive items always have the same hechsherim, and the least expensive items always have different the same hechsherim. And the reason for that, as I said, it's not politics. It's just that the less expensive items, those hechsherim, let's just say that they're not necessarily demanding all that much of the manufacturers, and the hechsherim on the products which cost double the amount are demanding a lot more. And therefore, it would be very unwise for a person to say, what are you talking about? You can't get tefillin batim that are kosher lechatchila for less than $400. I see batim with a hechsher says on a kosher lemahadrin min hamahadrin, you know, for $200-$300. So what are you talking about? And the reality is that if people would go down to the factories and see what's going on there, where they're producing 2,000 batim monthly, the situation is very, very, very problematic. I know that you're involved with the OU a little bit. The OU would never give a hechsher on such facilities. And I would say that if somebody is about to buy Stam, whether it's batim or ritzuos, it's definitely worthwhile keeping in mind the idea that if one hechsher is charging double the amount of a different hechsher, it's probably a very good reason for it, and it would be a good investment in one's olam hazeh and one's olam haba.
Wow, okay. Thank you very much, Rabbi Mendelitz. Thank you for sharing your time and your knowledge. And there aren't that many people that have this knowledge in this area, and certainly not that many people that can express it so clearly and so practically. So we thank you very much for coming on the program and for helping us out in this area.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on, and you should continue to be mezakeh the rabbim through all of your shiurim and all the other activities that you're involved in. Klal Yisrael is very appreciative for all of that. Yeshikayach to you.